On Tech News Today, President Obama orders federal agencies to create the fastest supercomputer ever made. Google responded today to France's order to censor the global internet. And we'll tell you about a Japanese home robot that's going all corporate on us. It's all coming up next on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Thursday, July 30th, 2015. This episode is brought to you by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/twit and receive a $50 Visa gift card when you get a loan. And by Intel. Small business owners can't afford to choose between A or B. If both help your business, you want A and B. With Intel Power 2-in-1s, you get performance and mobility, power and freedom. That's the power of and. Experience it at smallbusiness.intel.com. Tech News Today is a show where we talk about the tech news with the journalists who report it. My name is Mike Elgin, and our co-anchor today is Politico reporter Zoya Sheftalovich. Welcome to the show, Zoya.
Thanks, Mike. Great to be here again.
I'm so glad you're here. Now, you've been on the show a couple of times as a guest, an interview guest, and we tried to get you on a couple of shows over the last few weeks, but you were super busy doing something really important. Can you tell us about your amazing trip in the Mediterranean?
Oh, you know, I've just been working so hard on a sailboat in Turkey. It's just been, it's been so tough. I've been napping and reading books and swimming, and it really just takes it out of you, you know?
I've heard about napping. I read about that on Twitter. So you basically just, you were in a sailboat, actually, and you were going like from coastal place to coastal place along the Turkish coast. Is that right?
Yeah, I was on a wooden gullet, which is the traditional transportation. Wow. And we were just going from one place to another. I started in Bodrum and I made my way around the Turkish Riviera and dropped in on a few Greek islands just for fun, you know. It was just a pretty exciting adventure.
Sounds brutal. Sounds brutal. That actually sounds really, really great. I'd love to do that someday. Well, we have to set aside the imagery of a lovely sailing adventure in Turkey and get right into the ugliness of Silicon Valley earnings reports, starting with our top story. Facebook beat expectations for the second quarter, raking in $4 billion in revenue and $719 million in profits. Tom Risen is a reporter for U.S. News & World Report and joins us now. Welcome to the show, Tom Risen.
Thank you very much. Yes, and there is Facebook in Turkey, so it's not completely off the topic.
Well, when they're not banning it, there's Facebook in Turkey. Now, revenue is way, way up, but profits are down. Should we make anything of those two particular trends?
Yeah, the big takeaway from this earnings report is that Facebook has had a really, really busy quarter. They have been unveiling all these new projects. Instagram has e-commerce features now. Facebook is testing a buy button, and they've also purchased a lot of companies the past year. Like, they spent $19 billion on WhatsApp last year. And this earnings report shows that hasn't paid off yet. This is a long-term investment, and CEO Mark Zuckerberg told people be patient. But the increased costs of all these projects and all these acquisitions led to a 9% drop in profits for their earnings report. And Wall Street is becoming more patient with tech firms, but they're all about the bottom line. So this did not do well for their stock. Their stock is lower this morning. It's had a good run for a pretty steady past few months, but they've been dipping because they want to see profit.
And what's the role of mobile advertising in Facebook's numbers? Are they making that pay for themselves?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Mobile advertising is the second big takeaway from the earnings report, because Sheryl Sandberg said that mobile advertising is now 75% of all their ad revenue. And advertising is where they get most of their money. So they're a mobile-first company now. Like, last year, it became the first time that this time last year, 64% of their advertising from mobile, that's where it came from. So that's when they really became a mobile-first company. But now they are firmly in the mobile space. And Sheryl Sandberg said that they get about 1 minute out of every 5 minutes that you spend on a smartphone in the United States. That's spent on the Facebook app. It's that popular. So they They also hope to expand their mobile audience with their internet.org project. They want to get more people in other countries online so that they'll use their mobile app, because most people outside the United States who use Facebook use it on their mobile phone. So they're just diving right into the mobile space.
You know, it's no small miracle that Facebook is making a ton of money on mobile. There was a couple of years there where it looked like nobody could figure out how to do it except for Google. Google's the only company for a long time making any money on mobile, and Facebook was trying and trying and trying and failing, and now they're trying and succeeding. So that's really interesting. And Facebook is also really, really good at getting people to spend lots of time on Facebook. And as you mentioned, they're spending a lot of time on the app as well. That's really important, I think. Now, Twitter's call this week, by the way, was tarnished by slow user growth. Facebook is really not having that problem, are they? And is there a connection, do you think, Tom, between Twitter's slow growth and Facebook's fast growth? Is Facebook stealing users from Twitter?
I don't think it steals users from Twitter, because people use it for different reasons. Like myself, I'm on at Tom Risen on Twitter. That's my work account. But I also have a Facebook account, which is a lot more personal. That's pretty much how people treat the two sites. So I don't think they're stealing users, but I do think that Facebook gets more users because Facebook is lighter than Twitter. Twitter is like, you know, news and breaking developments, and Facebook is pretty much everything. It's very visually engaging. They have a lot more video options. Twitter's catching up with video, and, you know, photos are obviously easier to find on there with all their hashtags and location. But Facebook has really poured a lot of effort into video and making it more engaging. And they bought Oculus too, so they're hoping that 3D video will, a few years down the line, become the next big thing for the way that we communicate with each other. So I think that's it. I think that it's more engaging. They're spending more ways to get us interested in sharing things on Facebook.
And can Facebook keep growing, given that it seems like roughly half of the world's online population is already on the Facebook platform? What are they going to do to keep getting those new users to sign up so that that revenue keeps going up as well?
Well, in the United States, you're right. In the United States, it's pretty maxed out, because just about everybody who's going to be using Facebook in the United States is using it. And so, in fact, some people are leaving it, not in huge droves like you hear in the press, but, you know, it's not as popular as it was a few years ago in the United States. But in other countries, it's becoming even more popular, because this is a very easy way for people to promote their business. If you're in a country that has censorship, like Turkey, it can be a way for you to get your activism out. It can be a way for you to talk about news that the government doesn't want you to talk about. And internet.org is their project to get more people online, because we're pretty fortunate here in the United States. Almost everybody has internet in some form, and other countries aren't as fortunate, especially places like Africa. So they've been putting a huge focus on Africa to get more people online. That's where they're going to get more of their users from.
And a lot of those emerging economies, the problem is that they have to pay for every, you know, megabyte that they use in terms of data. They're, you know, it's like they use twice as much data, they pay twice as much for data. And so it's a really tough proposition to say, oh yeah, come to Facebook and just spend all, you know, hours and hours looking at people's videos and pictures. It's a tough request. But if Facebook is subsidizing it and making it free for them, then they're going to be incentivized to do that. And of course, we reported earlier this week that Facebook is expanding internet.org to cover any carrier that wants to get involved. Google has a similar program for getting people online for free. It tends to be much quieter than Facebook's. Facebook's used to be quiet before they came out with this whole internet.org thing. And it can't be, underappreciated how many users and how powerful Facebook has become. They have 1.4 billion on Facebook. They have something like 600 million on the Messenger app by itself. They got Instagram, which has 300 plus million. They've got WhatsApp, which got 700 or 800 million. I mean, they really kind of have cornered the market for massive users on social and messaging apps. And then something else happened this week that I thought was really astonishing. People always hated Facebook, but used it anyway. Now people are starting to like Facebook. A new study came out that they've risen from the bottom of the barrel in terms of customer satisfaction to about the middle. So now they have risen to become a mixed bag. can anything stop Facebook at this point, Tom? They are just, I just don't see any. They got all the users. Now they have users loving them. They've got internet.org to where they're going to get the next billion users. I mean, can anything stop Facebook at this point?
Well, I'm old enough to remember when people thought MySpace was the big thing and that Facebook was just for college kids who could only log in with their email account from their college. So never say never. I mean, Snapchat is making waves. Their CEO reportedly refused to sell to Facebook, which was reportedly interested. So they need to keep going. I think that they've really responded to a lot of the privacy concerns, a lot of the compatibility concerns that people voiced about Facebook over the past few years. And since they've become a publicly traded stock, they've really put a lot of effort. They've had a fire under them to fix those problems. So that, I think that's what's driving them. But they know that they have to keep sharp because the people who use social networks the most are people who are under the age of 20. And people under the age of 20 are still a little bit on the fence about Facebook. They're not leaving in droves like some of the hype says, but they do have other options these days like Yik Yak and Snapchat. And there's, I think the past few years we had a social network boom where people tried to start a social network for just about everything. A lot of those didn't work, but there's still a lot of interest out there for people to, because people know it's valuable now. Like Facebook has 1.5 billion users on the web. They announced that yesterday. And 1.3 billion users on mobile. So they're definitely growing, but they know they have to stay sharp and they have to stay ahead of the competition, which is still there.
Heck, I remember when CompuServe was unstoppable. And of course, you mentioned that the changing trends, it will always keep changing. I mean, as you mentioned, there was a social networking boom. Then there was a messaging boom. Facebook was all over that with its acquisitions, especially WhatsApp. And now I think the eyeballs are gravitating increasingly toward video sites, especially YouTube, and Facebook is all over that too. So they're trying to stay ahead of it. I've heard somebody say this week that Facebook's the best run company in Silicon Valley, and that very well may be true. Tom Risen is at usnews.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Tom Risen. Tom, thank you so much for joining us today on Tech News Today.
Have a great day.
Well, we got some more news for you coming right up, but first I want to talk about, we're talking about money already. Let's keep talking about money. Prosper is one of our sponsors today. Prosper can let you borrow up to $35,000 in as few as 5 days and use the money for just about anything you want. It's a new way to borrow money. They invented the category of this type of loan, and they enable people to invest in each other. It's both financially and socially rewarding. For example, let's say you want to make your business more environmentally friendly. You want to build solar paneling and you want to make some other improvements that will help reduce your carbon footprint for your company. You can do what they call an environmental loan. So you go on the site and you set it up for that purpose. And then somebody else, an investor who wants to also help the environment, can go and invest in your project. You get the money, you build your project, and everybody wins, and it's also a great investment for the investor. They've got 2 million members. They've facilitated $4 billion in borrowing, and they've just empowered a whole lot of people, hundreds of thousands of people. Now and for limited time, Prosper is offering TWIT viewers and listeners a $50 Visa gift card with your low-interest loan. You can get up to $35,000 in your account in as few as 5 days and a $50 Visa gift card. Just go to prosper.com/TWIT for this special offer that's just for you. President Obama yesterday signed an executive order authorizing the creation of a new program called the National Strategic Computing Initiative, or NSCI. Clint Finley is a reporter for Wired and joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to the show, Clint.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. What the heck is the purpose of the NSCI?
So a number of different government agencies have already been working on developing supercomputers for basically since supercomputers were invented. So the new initiative is going to bring those different agencies together, the Department of Energy, the National Science Foundation, the Department of Defense, and then various other organizations that within the government. And the grand goal is to build the first supercomputer that can perform the first exascale supercomputer. So the first that can do an exaflop level of calculations, which is a measure of how many calculations it can do in a second.
So how fast exactly is an exaflop?
It's 1,000 petaflops, which is about 30 times as fast as the fastest supercomputer in the world right now.
So that's a lot of flops.
Yeah. And yeah, it's something like 10 to the 18th power flops or something like that. I think maybe I can't remember the exact number.
A lot of flops. And a flop is a floating point operation per second. It's a rate of floating point operations. Now, is this being driven by the need for scientific progress or by the need to be better than China?
Probably both. I think that it's really hard to ignore the fact that China has currently they have the fastest supercomputer in the world, and a lot of researchers are getting nervous about that. The U.S. has always been very competitive with other countries in terms of its scientific development. But there are a lot of reasons that we would want faster supercomputers. They can be used in climatology for doing things like predicting hurricanes, or longer term predicting the effects of climate change. There's national defense issues in terms of developing weapons or fighter planes and that sort of thing. So there are a lot of practical reasons that we want this as well.
Let's talk money. This all sounds extremely expensive. What is this going to cost in the end?
We don't know yet. The specifics of this initiative are still pretty vague. At this point, it's just about getting all the different agencies together to make plans and set goals. So there's no specific funding for this initiative yet, as far as I know.
It's not going to be cheap. I'm going to go out on a limb there and say, no, this is going to be expensive. And I think I need one of these Exaflop computers just to keep up with Google Chrome and all the plugins and also Google Drive. But that's just my problem. I'll deal with it some way without President Obama somehow. Well, Clint Finley is at clintfinley.com. He's also at wired.com. You can follow him on Twitter at Clintron. Thank you so much for joining us today, Clint.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we told you in the past about Google's Loon experimental program to use high-flying balloons to relay internet connectivity to remote areas. Well, it's an experiment no more. The government of Sri Lanka announced yesterday that it'll be the first country in the world to get nationwide internet access from Project Loon. Unbelievable. Zoya, I don't know if you have been following it as a project, but everybody kind of said this is a really, really kooky idea. What's interesting about it to me, whether it works as an idea, whether it actually delivers good internet to an entire nation like Sri Lanka is one question, but the technology behind it, the advancements they've made just in the ballooning part of it, they've broken records, for example, for how long a balloon can stale off. But I'm just fascinated by this kind of moonshot by Google.
It's absolutely incredible. And I know the talk around Brussels has been, you know, what can Google do to increase its market share? Because in Europe, particularly in Belgium and countries like Belgium that are quite small, I mean, Google has like 90-95% of the search market. So the question on everyone's lips has been, how can Google continue growing their market share given that they've got such huge amounts of the market captured in places like Europe and in the US and Australia, where I'm from? So I guess this is one way to make sure that you keep growing your user base. Just give people internet in the third world and in countries like Sri Lanka and Africa, I think they're also talking about, and keep growing that user base.
Yeah, and I assume that they have some way to monetize this. So this is one of the things that I like personally about advertiser-supported services, because they involve a transfer of wealth from rich to poor, basically. If you charge a fee for your services, then there are lots and lots of people who can't afford it, and you have a built-in digital divide. But here we see Facebook and Google subsidizing connectivity, building out infrastructure to make sure that the internet reaches people who wouldn't otherwise have enough money to make it worthwhile for companies to go in and build out infrastructure. And it's a beautiful thing. So we'll see how this works for Sri Lanka, and we'll be covering that as it goes forward.
Hopefully someone gives them smartphones to use the internet on.
Right. They're just going to have to, you know, take it in with nothing. You know, that's the other thing that's so great about the smartphone industry. We're seeing the prices of smartphones just dropping like crazy. And in a country in really emerging economies, where people are getting their first phones, when they get a smartphone, that will be their only computer. They're not going to have, like, you know, an exaflop computer at home and a laptop carrying around plus a smartphone, that smartphone's going to be it. So hopefully they'll have good smartphones as well. That's a good point. Well, we've been reporting on France's ultimatum for Google: censor the global internet for all EU citizens according to Europe's right to be forgotten rules, or else face a huge fine. Today, Google has responded. Their answer was no. A global spokesperson said, quote, "We've worked hard to implement the right to be forgotten ruling thoughtfully and comprehensively in Europe, and will continue to do so. But as a matter of principle, we respectfully disagree with the idea that a national data protection authority can assert global authority to control the content that people can access around the world." So yeah, I think this is a fascinating thing that Google's making the same arguments that all of the critics have made about this. How is this going to play in Europe?
Well, this is a really interesting area at the moment, because there's a tension in Europe between, on the one hand, privacy advocates who really are very strong in Europe in terms of the right to be forgotten and in terms of the sorts of privacy rights that they demand from apps like Facebook and others, or programs like that are available. So data breaches are treated very, very seriously in Europe. But on the other hand, there's also this feeling that free speech needs to be supported. So it is a tension around whether we're going to be actually allowing Google to continue listing results that might not be desirable to particular countries' governments. So we know there's a lot of stuff going on talking about Turkey. In Turkey, in terms of the opposition parties there getting access to Facebook and to search results that are banned. And on the other hand, you've got people who are saying, oh, well, you know, if there's an unsavory post about me on the internet somewhere, then Google should scrub that result from their search results if it's past a certain period of time and if I no longer think it's relevant. It's very tense, and it's going to be interesting how it plays out.
What's weird to me about it is that there's censorship in every country on the internet. For example, child pornography. In Germany, Nazi imagery and content is banned. Every country has different types of censorship. But the way that works is that the content is illegal. What's weird about the right to be forgotten is that the content is legal. They just require the search engines to be inaccurate and damage the search engine so that it doesn't give the result that's actually there and allowed to be there by European law. So that's one of the weird things. And I think in the end, it's just one of the symptoms and one of the difficulties of globalization, isn't it? Because, in the old days, you could censor stuff locally and that was enough. Problem solved. But now you have a whole global internet. And it's interesting because Peter Fleischer, who's the Google's global privacy counselor, said he had his own examples. He said in Thailand, you can't criticize the king, right? So they would like to extend that ban globally, I'm sure. Turkey criminalizes speech that is critical of Ataturk, not to mention the current president. And Russia outlaws some speech that is deemed to be gay propaganda. This was all part of Google's official response to France today. And, it's a great point. Every national government would love to censor globally. It's just once you go down that, we'd end up with no internet because everything would be censored because, women who don't have their hair covered is going to have to be censored globally by somebody, And so it has to be, they have to draw a line in the sand. It's nice to see they're doing it here.
Yes, and it'll be a question whether the French authorities respect that reply or if they're going to pursue this further. And thus far, France is one of the European countries that really are very much serious about pursuing the large tech companies when it comes to things like privacy. So I wouldn't be surprised if France respectfully disagrees with Google's respectful disagreement.
Yeah, and there seems to be also a fine line between kind of European or French nationalism in some of the rulings that we've seen, and the need to actually uphold European privacy laws. For example, there was a French Senate bill. I'm not sure if that ever passed into law, but the idea was that when people search for a certain service that Google has one of, they would not only be required to show two or three competitors as part of that result, no matter what the algorithms churn up, and that one of those would have to be a French company. I mean, it just gets to be pretty ridiculous at some point. I think that for the most part, most of the European rules and laws. You know, there's so many agencies and privacy watchdogs, and, you know, there's one in every country, and then there's the European ones. I think most of them are pretty, you know, they're trying to enforce the law, and it's very difficult with these global companies like Facebook, Google, and so on. But in France, I think they give that little extra something.
France is notoriously very protectionist, and certainly this is, I mean, it's the same when you look at other tech companies that have come in and the ways that French government authorities have tried to stop them. So Uber is a great example of a company that France has wholeheartedly rejected, and we've seen all sorts of huge protests happening. I mean, people have been beaten up, and the French authorities side with the French taxi drivers rather than actually looking at the situation and perhaps considering ways of allowing both parties to actually function together. And one of the solutions that the French government has been considering is potentially at market value buying all taxi licenses, which currently cost hundreds of thousands of euros, so that they can essentially buy out the taxi drivers. So it just gives you an idea of how powerful the various lobbyists and unionists in France are, and how likely the French authorities are to protect those local industries.
That's another slippery slope. You don't want to set that precedent either, because if anyone can buy everything, it's Silicon Valley companies. You know, maybe Uber will buy them all and buy all the licenses. And they've already, you know, big case in New York. I don't know if you're following that, where Uber got into a big war with the mayor and the city council and won. They did it by having all these ads that show how many people were employed by Uber and what a great thing it was for the people. And finally, the mayor blinked and said, okay, we'll back off. And so that's an interesting precedent as well. But lobbying has become a huge, huge thing for these companies, especially Uber. They are major lobbyists. They even throw in free rides for people in power.
And free ice cream sometimes.
Ice cream is even better than rides sometimes. Well, the Japanese telecom giant SoftBank says its Pepper robot will become available for enterprises in Japan on October 1st. The non-consumer version will be called Pepper for Biz. The robot is designed to read and express emotions through gestures, facial expressions, and voice. Pepper is backed by a cloud-based artificial intelligence system. The business version will come with pre-installed apps for enterprise use. Interestingly, you can't buy a Pepper robot. It has to be rented by paying a monthly subscription of about $442 per month for 3 years, which totals $16,000 or thereabouts. At the end of the three-year contract, the robot has to be returned to SoftBank. It's an interesting model, Zoya, and it's different from, say, the in Japan, the Aibo dog robot, which you could buy. And now the batteries are dying and people are having funerals for their Aibo robots.
It's really interesting. I guess this is the direction we're heading in with high-tech stuff now. I mean, with lots of things, consumers don't necessarily expect that they own something in perpetuity. They know that they're sort of loaning something or streaming something from a company. So I guess this is like the next generation of streaming to the extreme. But my question is, I mean, what are these... What do you think people are going to be using these robots for? Are they going to be reading people's emotions in call centers? What's going to be the deal?
I mean, that would be my guess. I had the same thought. I mean, you're not going to have them doing, you know, IT support or something like that, I hope. But you know, there's a hotel in Japan that has a robot, or there's both a hotel and a department store that's using this female, very realistic looking robot to answer questions. So it sits there and says, oh, let me tell you about the hotel. And it's a gimmick. It's a parlor trick. And that's one kind of use you can imagine. What I'm excited about, and I've sort of experienced this for myself with the Amazon Echo, it's the power of the cloud. In the old days, you know, a few years ago, you'd get a robot. Look, you know, we talked about the Aibo robot. You know, that Aibo robot had chips in it. It had memory in it. It had software running on it. It was on its own, and you could update it and stuff like that. But nowadays, everything's in the cloud. So in this case, Pepper is tapped into this, you know, massive data center. And the best part of that is that they're constantly updating it. It's not like you have to do a patch or anything like that. It's just the robot gets smarter and smarter every single day. And I see that with the Echo, the Amazon Echo. This is a consumer electronics product that never needs to be replaced, because the improvement will always be in the cloud. So that's a really, really powerful thing for robots. I think that's the model that's going to work for the foreseeable future, is that the brains of these robots are not going to be in the robot. They're going to be off in some data center somewhere. So,
would you pay $16,000 for 3 years of Pepper?
Yes. my wife would not, however, and therefore I will be pepperless for the foreseeable future. But I would. I'd rather have that than a car. But that's just me. Well, in security news, we told you on Tuesday of last week that Google and other companies had slammed a proposed set of export controls that originated in a multinational association called the Wassenaar Arrangement, which had been taken up by the U.S. Department of Commerce. Proposals would have reclassified intrusion tools as weapons and banned their export. The objection was that those same tools are used and exported every single day in the normal course of discovering vulnerabilities and protecting against hackers. And now the Commerce Department has decided to rewrite the rules. The move is a direct response to criticism and pressure from the security community, the tech industry, and even some grandstanding congressmen who have been vocal about it in recent days. And they all agree that the previous rules would have weakened cybersecurity. You know, sometimes, Zoya, the good guys win. In other cases, they haven't. For example, the FBI and other government law enforcement agencies, including the Department of Justice, have said that, you know, they want backdoors to encryption. That's another example like this where, you know, these people in government have this rosy view that, oh, we can fix this problem that is counter to what all the experts are saying is the actual solution. In this case, you know, banning the use of tools that are used to ferret out vulnerabilities would have been something of a disaster.
Yeah, and it's just crazy to think that what we've got is this dual kind of move. On the one hand, everyone's talking about the sorts of vulnerabilities that exist in banking software and in all sorts of payment softwares. And on the other hand, we're taking away the ability of those companies to actually fully investigate where those vulnerabilities lie and slamming those companies for all sorts of infringements. In Europe, what we're seeing at the moment is several governments and on an EU level, a discussion about the sorts of penalties that the data protection authorities can lay down against companies that lose data and weren't doing everything they could to keep that data secure. But when you're talking about then at the same time limiting their ability to encrypt that data or giving someone in the government the ability to get that backdoor into that data storage, that's just the sort of thing that creates these sorts of data breaches in the first place. So it is quite crazy, but great to see that we've had some sense in the end seen.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've seen some unexpected sort of populism within the executive branch of government recently, starting with the FTC and net neutrality, which I didn't think would happen, and it happened, and that was a shocker. So this is another example. We got some more news for you coming right up, but first let's talk about power and flexibility. Intel is one of our sponsors, and for small business owners, there's absolutely no room for compromise. You have to get your computers right, you know, and you don't want to spend a fortune and then have to upgrade right away. You can't afford to choose between one thing or the other. You can't afford to choose between hard work or innovation. You need hard work and innovation. You need versatility and strength. And Intel-powered 2-in-1s is that technology. You know, in the old days, it used to be that, you know, laptops were powerful enough and tablets were underpowered. Now the technology is advanced. Intel technology is advanced to the point where the processors are so powerful that you can have a tablet that's as powerful as the most powerful laptops. And this is the way to go because, of course, sometimes you want a tablet. People love using tablets. It's a great way to interact with a computer, but sometimes you need that keyboard. It's not a good solution to be carrying around a keyboard that's not an integrated part of the device. With some types of 2-in-1s, you can remove the keyboard altogether, and then it snaps in when you need it. With the other kind, it just flips around and becomes the back of the tablet. And then you just go right back into tablet mode. It's so powerful because these fifth generation Intel Core processors run business applications up to 2.5 times faster than a 4-year-old laptop. They run 8.7 hours or 2.6 times longer than a 4-year-old laptop, according to Intel. Powerful, long battery life, and no compromises. And that's basically what you get with Intel's 2-in-1s. They also have very powerful wireless display technology. You can stream all the things you need, presentations, videos, websites, and more live from your PC to your display. Very powerful way to work. Experience the power of and. Visit smallbusiness.intel.com and find out how Intel-powered 2-in-1s can improve your small business. That's smallbusiness.intel.com. And we thank Intel for their support of Tech News Today. Samsung reported earnings yesterday. Revenue dropped 7% and profit dropped 8% from the year-ago quarter. The company earned $41.7 billion in revenue, not bad, and made just below $5 billion in profits. The drop was the fifth year-over-year profit drop in a row. Galaxy S6 sales fell below the company's expectations, and low-cost Chinese Android phones are eating away at Samsung's lead, especially Zoya, in the mid-range of the market. What's happening is that a lot of consumers are choosing lower-cost Chinese mid-range phones that instead of Samsung's high-end phones. Phones have gotten so powerful now that even the mid-range ones are super powerful, and they can be so cheap from those Chinese companies.
Exactly. I mean, you've got companies like Huawei coming in. You've got all sorts of companies that are now flooding the market with loads of really cheap phones that have the same specs or similar specs to those Samsung Galaxy phones. And on the other hand, when you've got consumers choosing between those high-end phones, some are choosing the iPhone, which can be, you know, a more sort of conventional choice, particularly in certain markets, they're more popular. And it's hard to show consumers why it's worth paying an extra $400 or $500 for something that doesn't do all that much more than a standard Android. And certainly when you look at the sales of those Samsung Galaxy S6 and their Samsung Galaxy Edge phone, which is really just a cosmetic type of difference between the S6 and that Edge, you have to wonder why anyone would necessarily choose to pay a few extra $100 for something that doesn't seem all that special.
Yeah, you can just buy another phone and have a second one. Sony, on the other hand, reported yesterday tripling of profits in the same quarter of last year. They made $665 million on revenue of $14.5 billion. The company is emphasizing the sale of high-end components like smartphone cameras that are sold to the likes of Apple and Samsung, rather than consumer products like TVs and their own brand of smartphones. The company also reported that its PlayStation 4 video game console drove a 12% rise in revenue for its gaming unit. I think Sony is finding itself, and it's finding that its components are best of breed. People love them. They make a lot of money on them, and that's really where they should be, not making smartphones themselves so much.
Absolutely. They've pulled out of a bunch of markets that haven't been particularly profitable for them. Even, for example, they were in computing. They had some pretty high-end and popular tablets. Laptops there for a while that people quite enjoyed, but they just weren't making as much money and clearly weren't selling enough to continue running that side of the business. So they're certainly finding what they do best, concentrating on that and making the money where there's money to be made.
Yep, absolutely. Well, we've got some big numbers for you. 15, that's the percentage of Americans who don't ever use the internet. The percentage has remained unchanged for 2 years. Over the age of 65, that percentage rises to 39%. Besides age, the other two factors that are associated with non-internet use are poverty and education level. Fascinating, Zoya, that this number is kind of stabilized. You figure it's just going to, you know, you would assume, I think logic would dictate that the number of people not using the internet would shrink and shrink and shrink and shrink and then vanish. But it's not. There's a pretty stable group of people who just never use the internet.
So. There is, and it's really, really interesting. It'll be interesting to see what happens with that number when we get 15, 20 years down the track. I think we will see that drop, although perhaps in some places more than others, because in some areas of Europe, it's much higher than 15%. You're looking at something like 25, 30% of people have never used the internet. So I think in this case, Europe is definitely behind the US in terms of internet use and penetration.
And of course, you joined them while you were on that sailboat, no doubt.
I did. No reception. It was glorious.
Yeah, awesome. I remember when airplanes were this safe place where you could go and nobody could reach you. Those days are gone because you have to go to a sailboat now to get away from the internet. Well, our TNT fan of the day is Sack S. in Louisville, Kentucky, who posted this picture on Google Plus and Twitter. She said she watches Tech News Today while taking a bath. Somebody commented on that, and she said she watches two Twit shows. One of them is Twit on Sunday. The other one is Tech News Today, which is Monday through Friday. So we can only assume that she doesn't bathe on Saturday. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup or your bathtub and post it on Instagram, Google Plus, Twitter, or Facebook and use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT so we can find it. Zoya, what are you working on these days? First of all, what is your beat exactly at Politico Europe? And what are you working on these days?
My beat is a tech policy beat. So I'm all about anything that's happening in the European Union at that high level when it comes to tech news, and also on a national level in Europe to a certain degree. Of course, I cover US developments as well, because you can't be a tech news reporter without doing that. What are we working on right now? Well, Europe is in summer break, and literally basically everyone in the European Commission and Parliament shuts down for the summer in August. So it's a great time for me to be getting into some of the more long form features. And of course, just making sure that I'm keeping on top of what's happening at the big guys like Google and Facebook and Uber. I could just probably rename my beat Uber and Facebook and Google, and then I'll focus on those three. It seems like that's all we're ever talking about in Europe right now.
Yeah, that sounds about right. And it's funny, in that part of Europe, everybody goes on holiday during August. In the United States, of course, Congress goes on long vacations, but the rest of us keep slaving away. And so anyway, it's very great to have you on the show today. I'm glad you survived your sailing trip, and hopefully we'll have you on again soon. Now, if you want to follow Zoya, she's at Zoya Chef. That's S-H-E-F. Is that correct? On Twitter?
That's right.
S-H-E-S. So Zoya Chef on Twitter. Follow her now. And thanks again. We'll like to have you again on the show very, very soon.
I'll see you soon, Mike. Have a great what's left of the week.
All right. Will do. Thank you so much. You can subscribe to Tech News Today on Spotify, Deezer, Stitcher, iTunes, YouTube, Feedly, Yahoo, TuneIn, RSS. So many options. You can choose your favorite way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. If you're ever in the Bay Area, come on in and watch us as part of our studio audience. You can send email to tickets@twit.tv before you come in. You can follow us on Twitter at Tech News Today TV, and you can follow me on Twitter at Mike Elgin. Also, don't miss our other news show, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific every single weeknight. Tonight's guest is Sam Maskovich from Ars Technica, and that is the Tech News Today. The show is produced by Jason Cleanthes and edited by Anthony Nielsen. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you tomorrow.